Tax Resolution Ninja Show, where we feature the top experts on all things tax to help you understand, navigate, and resolve all your tax-related issues.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're listening to this podcast. I'm Alan Rolnick. I'm the host of the Tax Resolution Ninja Show, where I feature leaders who help people with major life events, such as settling immigration, under insurance funding. You're going through a divorce, you have health issues, you've lost your job, and or you have sales and marketing issues, and lots of other stuff. The episode is brought to you by Tri-State Tax Resolution. You know, I'm an IRS practitioner. I help people who are in trouble. You know, they get a letter, and they open it up. They get scared, and so they don't know what to do. So they call me, and I help them through, solve the problem. We permanently fixed things. We either can get the liability knocked down, or we can put you on a payment plan so that no one comes to seize your assets or sell your children. So if you have a problem, or if you know anybody who's got a problem with the IRS or the state taxing authorities, have them give me a call. I can be reached at 718-841-7317 or my website at www.tristatetaxresolution.com. I have here today a renowned author who was a registered nurse. She became a doctor of chiropractic and an acupuncture specialist. Her name is Dr. Sylvie Hayman, and she's going to talk about her most recent book, Beyond the Holocaust. And I've read part of the book, beginning of the book, and I thought the story was just fascinating. So, Sylvie, I'm going to have you talk about the book. I'm going to ask you why you wrote the book. And what made you do that?
Thank you, Alan. And first, I just want to thank you for inviting me to your show. Why I wrote the book? Well, you know, it really started very innocently with my son begging me to write it. Mom, you've got a story there. But when my granddaughter told me the same thing, I decided maybe it is time. And I thought, well, I'll share my story of the beginnings of my life and through the war and everything with my family. But then I really thought about it, and I said, I can't do that. I need to make a message. I need to maybe make a awareness of the plight of immigrants, and especially the adolescent immigrant. So I thrusted myself into the book with the intention of hoping to enlighten people and readers as to what goes on, not just with the immediate problems that a refugee has, shelter and needing a home and needing money to just get settled, but what happens after the refugee is settled. So that's why I wrote the book. And I'm very happy that I did, because I really thought that most people knew what I was going to say, and it was just going to be something that, was common knowledge, but apparently it isn't. A lot of people are giving me feedback about the information that they're receiving and the empathy that they're showing for the voyage and the journey that I took with my family. So it's gotten a wonderful, wonderful reception, and I'm extremely happy about that.
I noticed in the beginning of the prologue that the story is basically your mother was telling you. Is that in her words?
Well, what is in her words is the first chapter, which is Out of Europe. That was the chapter where I talk about how we got out of Europe during the war, when Belgium was bombarded in 1940, and my family had to pick up and leave and take that journey through France and eventually Spain and into Portugal, and eventually we were able to leave Europe in time in different directions. So that is my mother's story. It is also the story that I heard from cousins and other relatives over the years. And that is the only chapter that I actually tell it's in my mother's voice. Because I was only a little girl. I was only about 2 years old. So I can't say that I remembered exactly that. But after that, when we went to Brazil, then it becomes a story that I tell completely from my own memoirs, from my own experiences. Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did your family wind up in Brazil? What made them go there?
Very large family. And my uncles had worked with the Resistance in World War I. And all of them were able to get into the United States. They were able to immigrate into the United States, except us. My father was German, and there was a quota system at the time. And my father could not get a visa to, into the United States, at least not within any kind of reasonable time frame. So we had to, I guess Mama they had two choices, leave my father and follow her family, her brothers and sisters, or stick with her husband and follow him. So we were very, very blessed. I don't like to even say the word fortunate, because it's not about fortune, it's not about being lucky. I believe it's about being blessed that we had two wonderful ambassadors, two different ambassadors. One was the ambassador to Portugal, Aristides Sousa Mendes, whom I knew always, had given us visas to enter Portugal. And from Portugal, we were able to leave Europe. That was one visa, very important visa. The other visa, which I only came across, believe it or not, during my research, doing this book, there was another ambassador. His name is not as familiar to me, but this ambassador was the ambassador to Brazil. And he too had big sympathy for the Jewish people. As a matter of fact, he was married to a Jewish woman. And he signed a bunch of visas, and they were diplomatic visas, and somehow we were able to get that. So, but there were diplomatic visas, which made my father very, very nervous. And that's how we got out.
And then after, how long were you in Brazil?
So we were in Brazil about 4 years, and that's where my memory starts to, pick up. I remember the apartment that we lived in very well. I was very sick before we got to that apartment. I almost died with diphtheria. That I don't remember. I really was completely in a coma, but I did recover, as you can see. And we stayed in Brazil because really we had no choice. We had to be very quiet because we had diplomatic visas, and we were kind of afraid that somebody would pick that up and send us back to the war, which was still going on. So we were there for about 3-4 years. Now, my father had three brothers who had immigrated to Argentina years and years and years ago, so, we were really without family in Brazil, and scared that we would be found out. And we decided that it would be a good idea to go to Argentina, since we couldn't go to the United States. We would go to Argentina because at least there we had family. So we were smuggled. We didn't just enter Argentina. We actually were smuggled through Portugal. I'm sorry, no, through, not to Portugal, through Uruguay, Montevideo, and we were smuggled into Argentina. And I remember that journey, bits and pieces of it, I remember quite well, and I do talk about that in my book. My book is actually Beyond the Holocaust, and it's an immigrant's search for identity. And this is really the crux of the book, my search for identity throughout my life. So yeah, so we went to Argentina just in time. I was 6 years old, and just in time for us to for me to start school, because I had not had any schooling while I was in Brazil. I had homeschooling, but not official schooling. Again, because we were afraid to be caught. And we went to Argentina when I was 6 years old, and I remember lots of portions of that life quite well.
And you spent a number of years in Argentina, about eight years.
We spent 8 years there, and you wouldn't think that 8 years is really not a whole long time to have any feelings of nationality or love for a country. But you know what? It all depends, Alan, on what 8 years those were. And those were very formative. Excuse me, very formative years of a person's life. When you start school from 6 to 14, if you think of your own life in terms of years between 6 years old and 14, a lot goes on. There's a lot of growth and a lot of experiences, your childhood, you're going into adolescence. So they're very, very important formative years. And so the 8 years that I spent in Argentina were loaded for me in many ways. I spent 2 years in a convent. My parents needed to settle, and they weren't sure where they were going to settle. They were still hoping to get a visa to go to the United States. They were even thinking about going to Israel because my mother had a sister there. But nothing was coming through. We were not hearing from, the Department of Immigration at all. So we had to settle, and my father had to get a job, find work, and get a place to live. And that's 2 years into me spending in a convent. And of course, it was a school.
Right.
And there I was, the only little Jewish girl in the entire convent.
Did they treat you any differently than they did the Christian children?
You know what? I think that the answer to that is mostly that they didn't treat me. And actually, the nuns were kind, and they tried very hard. Understand that I, at that time, still didn't know Spanish. And their French was a little... just like that, that wasn't too strong. So communication with the nuns and the teachers was not exactly easy for them or me. But when I say that there was no treating, and I'm talking about classmates. Now, mind you, I actually, we spent the day together, and then we also spent the night together because we slept in a very large dormitory. Mm-hmm. We had our little beds in this large dormitory. And the girls just kind of snickered, and they just had their little group, and they just kind of scurried fast in the halls. They didn't want to have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
Basically. Mm-hmm.
So then 1952 comes around, and you finally make the move to the United States.
Finally, yes. 1952. And all these years, I was... how do you say it? I was programmed, you're going to be going to the United States someday. You're going to be an American. So all these years, I was kind of very hyped about, oh my God, the United States of America. Of course, we saw films. We saw American pictures in the movies. This was the country I was going to go to. And it was the most exciting thing, And so when I was 14 years old, it finally happened that... my uncle issued an affidavit, which he had done before, but it was just not our turn to get a visa. So finally, we got a visa to come to the United States at the age of 14, a teenager. You couldn't have a worse time to immigrate another country, you know, where you don't know the language and you don't know the culture and you don't know the mores. It's probably the worst time in a person's life to immigrate.
And you had apparently had a fascination with Eva Perón.
She was a very pretty woman, and I sort of liked her. But later on, when I realized where she was coming from, my ideology of her, you know, sort of stepped down a bit. But at the time, you know, she was pretty, and she looked like a princess to me, like a queen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I actually, it was when I came to the United States, within a few months after that is when she died. And I knew that Argentina was mourning her, and I sort of felt very alone at the time, and I mourned her too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like finally hitting the shores where they tell you that the streets are paved with gold?
Well, you know, we got into the country and we came into Ellis Island, which closed about 2 years after that. And I talk about in my book, I think that's chapter 3 when I get into Argentina, a moment when I took my grandson, already a teen himself, and I was taking him to different places because he lives in Pennsylvania. So I was taking him to different places in New York. And I said, let's go to the Statue of Liberty. And so we take, you know, we go and we take the ferry. And Alan, I had an extraordinary, strange and bizarre reaction to seeing the Statue of Liberty from far away as I was getting closer and closer to her. I described that in the book because it revived my feeling of what happened when I saw her as a 14-year-old when our boat was coming and we saw the figure of the Statue of Liberty from far away getting closer and closer. I tell you the truth, I cannot even talk about it without having some emotional feelings right now. Even thinking about it brings some tears to my eyes. It was such a moment of awe to see this Statue of Liberty and knowing that I was coming into America. Awesome, beyond compare. And you know, I have wanted to be an American even before I even got to America, but it wasn't that easy to be American. You know, it's not just enough to want to be American. It's not just enough to have a paper that says you are a citizen, which I got about 8 years later, naturalization papers. That wasn't enough. To feel American, you really have to get into the language. And for me, it was very difficult. Yeah.
I would have thought, well, maybe not. I would have thought that since you knew French, that going to English might not have been that... I shouldn't say easy because it's not. It's, you know, not, you know, when you're used to speaking a language for a very long time and having forced to learn another language.
Right. Yeah.
I would have thought because they're not that. I mean, they're similar, but they're not. That it would have been a little bit easier for you.
And so did I. I had the same feeling because. Of course, I was spoke French is my native tongue. It's the first tongue that I have that was spoken to me, and I spoke. And when I went to Argentina, it really by the time I came back from that convent, I knew I could speak Spanish, and I learned it fairly easily. But here's the difference: I was now no longer at that age group, and learning a language under the age of 12 or so. Is a very different story than learning a language as you get a little older.
Yeah.
You see? And that's one of the distinctions that I point out in my book. Because I didn't, you know, Alan, I didn't want my book to be just a memoir. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stories out there. And so I have my story and so what? You know, so what? I didn't want that book to be that. I wanted that book to be something that people could learn from, understand the immigrant, that people could go a step further, not just the life of Sylvie Hayman and how she became an American. So that was more difficult. And I agree with you. I was so stunned that I had such trouble. One of the reasons was that I was a teen, I was in high school. You know, this. Remember when you were in high school, you had your buddies,
yeah,
you had friends. And if you had a foreigner, you kind of treated them nicely, but you didn't include them. I mean, if a girl was going to say to me, oh, I just met a boy, he's so cute, I would have looked at him and said, oh, what is she saying? You know, I couldn't have related to their story. So as a result, I didn't have too many friends in high school. I studied and studied. And again, I was in a situation where it was difficult socially to... to meet people. So it was difficult to learn and to get rid of the accent. You know, I worked very hard on that, very hard. I think I did a pretty good job most of the time, unless I speak a long time and people pick up an accent, but most of the time people don't really pick it up too much.
Yeah, it's like my Brooklyn accent, I guess. You know, I can't 70 years later, I can't shake it. So
It was a much more difficult journey than I realized, and I was still Argentinian. I still had a strong hold for the country that I felt in my heart was mine, but I didn't want that to be. I wanted to be American, and so there was a lot of tough roads to take, and that's really what the book is about. The identity, a national identity, and how important it is. And we take it for granted, you know, Americans, we take it for granted. We go to another country and then we realize, oops, now we're foreigners in another country. And what do we do? What do you do when you go to visit or a vacation in a foreign country? I think one of the first things is we get all excited if we meet somebody from our country.
Right.
Well, especially if it happens to be your same state. I mean, if you're in a restaurant, say in Europe, in Paris or whatever, Morocco, whatever, and you're in a restaurant and suddenly you hear somebody in the other table and they're talking English, but not just English. They're talking your kind of English. And you know that they're from New Jersey. You know that because of the way they said this and that. Well, I mean, you are going to go over and say, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, and I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but I heard you talk, and where are you from? And you strike up a wonderful conversation with somebody from your country in another country. And because nationality is a very, very powerful.
Right.
It's right. Very powerful.
Yeah. I know the couple of times that I've been to Europe, you know, to different parts of Europe, I mean, it's very uncomfortable just walking in, you know, just walking places, because I was the stranger. I was the American. And,
exactly.
I found it unsettling, and I had no intention of staying there. I just was there. It certainly wasn't easy, but so you came. You came to the United States. I assume your family settled in New York.
Exactly, we did settle in New York.
So how did you? What was it like going to school and trying to fit in?
Well, it was difficult, and as I said, I tried to make friends, but and it isn't that they were nasty with me. They were not nasty, but I was an outsider. They couldn't relate to me. I couldn't relate to them. It was difficult to communicate. So, you know, I went back in my mind to when I was six. And I said, wait a minute, you know, you were 6 years old and you were in an environment very similar. Nobody spoke to you too much. You were alone and you made it. You found yourself as a good friend. You found things to do. You didn't fall apart. You did okay. You survived. You can survive here again somehow. And I did. I just applied myself to my schooling. I 4 years later, I had a wonderful 94.6 average. I was an excellent student. And I survived that period. I just as I survived when I was much younger. It wasn't easy. And to tell you the truth, to the day of today, I still don't feel that I completely fit into any societal situation. I always feel a little bit set apart. You know, not good, not bad, just simply set apart.
Right, right.
It's not a bad thing.
How did your parents adjust?
Well, my mother adjusted fantastically well because she was finally back with her family. Her sisters, she had an enormous family. She had 7 brothers and 3 sisters. Not that they were all there. One of them was in Israel, but still, she had all these brothers and her one sister who was like the best friend for her always when she was in Europe, younger. So there she was, and they smothered her, surrounded her. They had parties. She did fantastically well. I'm afraid to the point where she neglected me a little bit. I mean, she didn't mean to, but she was so ecstatically happy to be back with her family that she really didn't pay too much attention to me. So there I was, no friends and mama not paying too much attention. And papi was also a bit, he had his problems because he had a lot of language barriers. Not fluent like my mother, who could pick up languages beautifully. So my father worked very hard, long hours, and he had lost his mother and his sister and 2 little and this nephew and a niece in the war. He found that out later. He was never the same man. So it was tough for him, but they still adjusted to America very well. You know, you would think that because I was younger, but I had a bit of a hard time, and it's all because I was a teenager. Do you remember what it was like when you were an adolescent? What should I do? Who am I? What do I want to do? You know, there's all these things that are going on of identity and aspirations, and that plus being in a country where you cannot express yourself makes it worse, makes it more difficult.
So you went to school, you got your RN, you got a degree in chiropractic.
Yeah.
And you did a lot of other stuff. What made you decide that writing, that you were going to become a writer?
You know, it is evident now to me that I always had that fiery desire or I'm not thinking of the right word, but I always had it in me to want to write. And I say that because when I was a nurse, I wrote several articles for prestigious nursing journals. But, you know, they were technical articles about certain surgeries and so forth. I remember one time I submitted an article to a nursing journal, and the editor sent me a letter back. I think she did accept the manuscript, but she said, "By the way, where are you from? You write with an accent." So she could tell that I was not American by the way I was writing. Right. And of course the editors helped me make it a little bit more Americanized, but that was a long time ago. And I remember being extremely satisfied and rewarded. And I loved the writing. And when I got married to Dave, one of the gifts that he gave me was this very fancy automatic type of typewriter, not your everyday typewriter. This was way before we had lovely word processors like we have today. But it was in there to write. And it lay dormant because I never thought in a million years, because language was difficult, it lay dormant there. And a few years ago, I met an author of many books, a historian. And I was actually instrumental in trying to get her nominated I did nominate her for the Women's Hall of Fame. And in the process of working with her, some of it rubbed off. We became good friends, but in the process of that experience of putting this together, this information about this author into this the Women's Hall of Fame, it revived some of my desires to write. And she was instrumental in encouraging me. She herself was a teacher at one time, a very supportive teacher. And she kept saying, "Oh, Sylvie, I love the way you just phrased that. Oh, Sylvie, this is beautiful how you put that words together." And something happened. And I decided to write a book on habits. At that time, you know, I am a health coach as well. And so much of health coaching has to do with establishing healthy and good habits. And I decided to give my own version of habits as a clinician, as a chiropractor and an acupuncturist and a nurse, and talk about habits. And that was my first book. And I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. I loved it. And I realized that in the wake of my, as I was getting older, that was a profession that I wanted to really end my life with. So I became a writer. That book was published in 1979, and I would say maybe almost 2 years to making it. So, I was in my late 70s at the time when I decided that just do the writing because you love it. And that's how I became a writer.
Are you working on another book right now?
Actually, I'm not working on another book. What I'd love to do is blog, and I'd like to submit some essays on various different topics. At my age, you can pick a lot of topics because we have the different journals and magazines, and put it out there. And then see whether, you know, something comes up that I might want to write another book. But right now, no.
Okay, that's great. One final question.
Sure.
Supposing you were given a Lifetime Achievement Award, who would you thank?
Oh my goodness, what a wonderful question that is. You know, it's a beautiful question because at the end of my book, I thank a lot of people. My last, if you could say, is it a chapter? I don't know. But the last thing in my book, Beyond the Holocaust, is on gratitude. And I thank a multitude of wonderful people that made me who I am today. But I just think that I have to, I really thank Hashem. I really thank God for just giving me the blessings that I've been given. All in all, there's so many people to thank that I really have to thank God.
That's great. That's terrific. Sylvie, I want to thank you very much for taking the time. And I really appreciate your being willing to go through my own insecurities here. So I thank you, and I hope we can do this again some other time.
Thank you very much, Alan, for having me. And for the folks who are listening, if you're interested in getting my book, it's on Amazon.com. It's also on Barnes & Noble, but less likely to be something that people go for. I have an offer that I can offer. If you go to my website, Sylvie Hayman, just sylviehayman.com, and you sign up for my newsletter, I would send you a Kindle version, an electronic version of my first book, Make It a Habit, Create Health and Happiness for Your Mind, Body, and Spirit, as a gift. So it's sylviehayman.com. And I would give you the link for the book, but I think it's just as easy to remember, Amazon.com.
That's great, Sylvie. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on the Tax Resolution Ninja Show. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Tax Resolution Ninja Show. Be sure to click subscribe to get updates on our latest episodes.